Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
8 o'clock. Sunday night, there's a man comes around and he makes things right. Everybody's feeling gay when they hear this fella say.
There's a really big shoe tonight. A really big show tonight.
We got 16 tons of atomic ore. We got
nine countries downgraded in Europe. We have earnings season getting underway. JP Morgan does a bit of a flop last week. We also have the Republican primary seeming to thin out a little bit. And we have some great guests. Denise Schull, an author, a psychologist, and a great book, Market Mind Games. And Katie North from Bloomberg's government division. And she's going to talk about the whole idea of systematically important banks. And yes, it is a really big show today. And I think that that great song by, oh boy, that takes us back, right? The Kirby Stone 4. It takes me beyond back. But I thought it was kind of funny. You know, I always think of, when I do this, oh, Ed McMahon and Johnny Carson and, you know, look at Ed Sullivan and look at, you know, Jay Leno. You know, what all those announcers would say and how they kind of, you know, how do they bring excitement to the show? I don't know. Anyway, so I thought that we'd open up with that little ditty, Ed Sullivan with his Rilleberg show. You know, there's a lot of things that are going on. You know, this is now already in the middle of January 2012, and already we're seeing some kind of interesting developments in the world markets that once again we're seeing a nice pop in the beginning for the Asian region. And then we're seeing, of course, another couple of days in a row that China, the Shenzhen, Shanghai, but the Shenzhen in particular is down 3% or more. And that was on worries of the European situation. Well, meanwhile, U.S. markets were closed on Monday. Futures were open, but U.S. markets were closed in observance of MLK, Martin Luther King Day. And what was interesting was that at first there was this big move down during the day on Friday, and there was some worry about France and maybe possibly Germany being downgraded. And then what we saw was at the end of the day, at the end of the day, this big move by the S&P by about 5 points to close the day, only down about 3 points or so, after being down close to about 10 points or so, 11 points, middle of the day. Now, overnight, Asia was reacting pretty negatively again, and then on top of that, we saw the European markets open up down, and miraculously, just out of nowhere, of course, there was a good bond auction on a short-term debt in France, and then, you know, the markets turned positive because, you know, it's what happened before, isn't it? When we saw the U.S. downgrade, it was kind of, you know, buy the rumor, or in this case, sell the rumor and buy the news. After the fact, we see, well, that's all they're going to be downgrading and how much it's going to hurt, and with the downgrade, in fact, there was a further run to safety. And all of this is mechanical. It's all a gigantic, I don't want to say mirage, but it's a mind game. And that's one of the reasons why we're going to bring on Denise Schull today. I'm very excited to talk to her about what is actually going on in these markets. It's a confidence game. It's the whole idea that we have to maintain confidence, and governments will go out and buy bonds, and there'll be in investment by, whether it's sovereign wealth funds or direct investment by governments. Japan does it. Korea does it. Several other countries do it. They put money directly to work in markets. And you thought that wasn't possible. You thought that QE was manipulation. Well, no. Around the world, they actually put money directly into the public shares in the markets in open market purchases. So there you have it. But yeah, nine countries were downgraded. Italy was downgraded a couple of notches. France downgraded one notch. And we did see, even before that, the long and short-term rates for those countries have been creeping up, but they kind of stabilized last week, which was good. One of the measures that I look at quite often, there's about five of them actually, but one of them is the Euro three-month basis swap. We've talked about this ad nauseum. I put this up on the site on the Disciplined Investor. And one of the things that you want to look at is, you know, what is the relationship of that over the over time? And then also on top of that, where is it going directionally. So where, what's the relationship between that and rates and the CDS rates and how much money is being kept at the ECB and directionally what's happening? Well, right now it's at 85. That's down by about 50%. It's a negative 85. It wasn't negative 165. But it's still down or better by 50% over the last several months. About 2 months ago, we had a high. And then all of a sudden, the U.S., the Fed, in a bit of a backdoor bailout that we've discussed, started to put some money into the into the European banking system in order to free up and create liquidity for their overall system. But most players are still saying that the banking system is relatively locked up, illiquid, and that's frustrating. Meanwhile, when we're seeing these three-month basis swaps actually move down or better, get better, that means that there's a little bit more trust. There's a bit more money that is flowing through the systems. The pipes aren't as clogged as they were before that. That's a good sign. And it's interesting, you have to wonder for a second, if the S&P downgrade, and whether there's other downgrades, is that late to the party? Are the rating agencies coming in kind of after the horse has been let out of the barn already? I mean, are they kind of coming in after everybody knows what the problems are? It seems a little likely that that's the case. Now, before we get to our guests, I want to mention a couple of different things. That, first of all, I mentioned that earnings season is underway. So now, over the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to get just an onslaught. We saw Alcoa, they came in right on, a little bit light, a little bit on. The CEO is a little bit more, I guess, a little more positive than was in the past. But remember something, one of the things that's going on is that smelters around the world, when it comes to various metals and industrial metals in particular, are actually, they're shutting them down. They're trying to raise prices. They're doing what they can to fight the waning demand and the waning pricing structure of various industrialized materials, and they're actually going to try to raise prices by slowing up, artificially creating demand by reducing down the production. So that's something that's going to be going on. You're going to see a lot of, I think, news about that and discussion. But that's one of the things that's happening there. J.P. Morgan came in at 90 cents. We tweeted this and talked about this and sent some emails out about this prior to their earnings. They came out with 90 cents. They came out with a little bit under the expectation for revenues. They had to come out with close to probably $1.05 or $1.08 in order to surprise the street, because historically they've been surprising by about 10 to 15%. And this time, it was kind of baked in already, the knowledge that there was going to be a severe slowdown in their trading operation, M&A. Maybe bonds would be a bit better off. And there's going to be a problem and some hits they're going to have to take from the European region. Now, with that, the fact is that we knew that was going to happen, and analysts already had reduced down earnings expectations. And on top of that, you saw a pretty big rally 2 weeks prior, 3 weeks prior to the earnings. Stock dropped out 3.5% on the news, and that wasn't really a lot if you consider if it was a tech company, it probably dropped about 40% on that news. You know, looking at outlook being questionable, and you're seeing a lot of the various rules that are taking effect here, and we'll talk about some more of that with Katie North coming up in a second. But I have a lot of questions lined up because she wrote two great reports for Bloomberg on this whole, as they call it, SIFI. Systematically important financial institutions, and what that means to everybody. But earnings is going to be starting to roll in very, very quickly next week and the week after. So you need to keep your eyes on that. We're actually in the process of developing a really, really cool, we'll call it a product, newsletter, subscription service, alerting service, that will give you a very good indication of what to expect with earnings. It's kind of a one-page, very intense, colorful, because it gives you areas to hit in terms of alerts and trigger points for when a stock should be moving up or down. Short-term trading, kind of between 10 days before and after an earnings announcement, but to know and also after the announcement in the after hours in the pre-market, where a stock has traditionally traded during that time, where you've seen earnings misses what happens, revenues misses what happens. And we do we'll call it an algorithm to come up with what the expectation of the street is and where the price is going to be, dependent on a variety of market indications. And it deals with the institutional buying and selling pressure And we've actually teamed up with a group called TAS to put that on paper and to come up with exactly what those levels are. Anyway, I'll have more of that another day. But the earnings season is here. Keep your eyes open. And remember, before you buy a stock, before you get into something new, check to see when the earnings are. You don't want to just get into something right before. That's a recipe for disaster, folks. Anyway, so I want to mention the Spearman indicator. We put up a chart that combines the Spearman indicator with the, it's called the Bloomberg Trend Stall Study. And I want you to look at it for yourself. It's over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You'll see it on the front page. And what's interesting about that is when you combine the two, when you get a combined signal, buy or sell, short or long, or, you know, turning points, if you will, on the market, you be the judge, but it looks pretty accurate to me over the last year or so. And I can go back a long time, probably about 2-3 years with this market condition, and it's been pretty accurate. Well, right now we're getting a bit of a stalling feature that looks like it has to be confirmed, but the Spearman is at a real high level and crossing down below the trigger. And on top of that, you have the stalling little triangle there that you'll see that is looking like it is a problem as well. At the same time, realize that the Economic Surprise Index, something that we're writing about in this quarter's commentary, they've been coming in pretty good. Matter of fact, if you look at the Economic Surprise Index, which is simply a look at, okay, what did analysts and investors expect the economics to come in at, and what did they come in at? And they do a bit of a calculation with that. Citigroup does this. And if you look at that, there's a gigantic spread right now between where the stock market is that correlates pretty well on a 3-month lag to where the Economic Surprise Index is in the U.S. It suggests that stocks should be higher. And this is something that a lot of hedge funds and institutional investors have been using, this concept of an economic surprise index, because in a way, the economy is led by earnings, or maybe earnings is led by the economy, depending on how you want to look at it, right? So you have a very strange set of circumstances where you have the Economic Surprise Index. Of course, we know in Europe is not good, in Asia has not been good, but in the U.S. is good, and that's probably why a lot of money is flowing here. So keep that in mind. We're going to write about that some more and talk about that some more, and we'll have that available at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, for our clients, get the full report. We're covering all sorts of things on a quarterly basis, and you can check out more information about that over at the website. All right, now, before we get to our guests, I want to mention one little ditty. You know, this time of year, it's kind of between the holidays, after the holidays. We got bad weather, sick days, especially up north, although it was cold down here this week. It was like 55, and my son actually had a bonfire outside, which was kind of ridiculous in South Florida, but it was kind of fun. But everybody, you know, kind of getting everybody together is often difficult, right? You don't know where anybody's going to be. You don't know who's going to be sick, stuck in the snow. And that's why GoToMeeting is one of these wonderful tools that even in the event of a time when, well, you don't need it that much, but wow, here you are on a day that you have to have a meeting, and wouldn't you know it? There's snow. There's sleet. There's a hurricane. I don't know, whatever it is. Well, there you go. You got GoToMeeting, and you can host a meeting online on your computer, and your attendees can be anywhere. They can be on an iPad, an iPhone, Android mobile device. And it's really easy for them just to hop on a meeting with you, collaborate in real time. And I love this GoToMeeting app. You know, you have this whole app right on your iPhone and iPad. Boy, this is so cool. It is so cool because you just kind of, the old ones, the old days when you tried to do remote access from a small device was really difficult. You know, it was kind of clumsy and it was small and this is nice. Anyway, I want you to go try GoToMeeting today, and you go to the App Store, the Android Market, anywhere you want, download the free app, and start joining GoToMeeting meetings and sessions from anywhere. Just go to GoToMeeting.com, click on Try It Free, the button there, and use the promo code PODCAST. All right, how about we get to our first guest? You know, a lot of times we talk about this whole idea of psychology. What's going on with the market, and why is it doing this? And it seems like, my gosh, it should be doing that, but what's the underhand, what's going on? So you know what? Why not try to figure it out in a different manner, or maybe not figure it out. So what I did was I read a great book. It's by Denise Schull. It's called Market Mind Games. Market Mind Games. And let me kind of read you just really quickly before we introduce Denise. This is a little kind of a press release, but I thought it really captured what she was talking about. It says, in this age of rapid technology advances and constant access to information, we've created an increasingly volatile stock market. check. Any hint of an economic downturn here or abroad and the masses panic resulting in plummeting market lows that can rebound in just days or sometimes hours. So in this book, she talks about that trading is not a calculating practice after all. It's less about the numbers and more about the emotions and the critical role they play. And Denise uses neuroeconomics, behavioral finance, and psychodynamics psychology to explain everything that we think, do, and feel stems from the social-emotional context in which what we do and how that understanding of conscious and unconscious emotions applies to trading. Okay, Denise, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. I was like, wow, that's a lot. Yeah. Even when he's reading it, it's a lot. So, and I get it.
Yeah, no, I understand. So listen, we know that there's this whole fear and greed. We could sum a lot of things up right there, right? And this whole fear and greed is an overpowering emotional process. But then a lot of people want to think about, well, the PE ratio is this, and you stick by it to that, and the stops. But kind of you've debunked some of that.
Yeah. Well, this is the first thing. It's a fact. And I mean fact, like irrefutable fact, that you have to have emotion to make a decision. So first of all, the whole idea of taking emotions out of market decisions is just sort of a waste of time. But it's worse than a waste of time. It actually misleads people. Because what ends up happening is in trying to take the emotion out of the decision, they end up acting out the emotion as opposed to using it as a piece of their data set that might help them make a better decision about their own personal situation.
So you did a lot of research, and in this book, it's kind of interesting. You blend a couple of things. You blend fictional and non-fictional together. So you tell a story, and then you kind of, in a way, describe it, how it is looking in and what's actually happening. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Okay. Yeah. I thought if I told a story that, depending on where you were coming at the material, it would be sort of easier to see it through the character's experience.
Right. So I dog-eared a lot of things, so you can hear me rustling through some pages. And you say here, this is the beginning of the prologue, you say, emotions are actually good. And that's what you're talking about right now, right? And there's a difference between this whole thing about risk and decisions that are based on emotions. And, I use an acronym that I think about. It's called FEAR. The F-E-A-R, false events appearing real. And there's different types of fear and there's different types of risk, and it depends on emotions versus calculated. So can you kind of go over some of that?
Well, first of all, actually, the real emotion of fear is the primary emotion of the market. Like, I'm not even sure I believe in greed. It's all different types of fear. So starting from fear of being wrong, fear of losing money, to sort of on the other end of the spectrum, fear of missing out, in the academic world, it's fear of future regret. But fear of missing out, for example, drives bubbles. Like everybody's thinking, okay, everybody else is in this thing, or I didn't get in this thing, and, I have to get in it because it's going to keep going up. And it's that emotion that people aren't aware that they're really feeling that causes the last buyer to appear in any sort of rally, and then why did I buy it then, and why didn't I buy it 2 years ago? So knowing what those emotions are that are actually operating for yourself allows you to say, wait a minute, is that relevant to the situation or not relevant? And it can be relevant. Emotions, like if you take a loss, it's not unreasonable to be afraid of taking another loss. We call it irrational because it's irrational from a probability point of view, but it's not irrational from a survival point of view.
Right. But I'm not going to end up dying if I take the loss.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And your psyche might consider dying more important than the probabilities.
So one of the things that is interesting is, you talk about fear of losing out, fear of missing. You have a stock and you own it and it's down. And then, you have now the fear of, oh my God, I'm going to lose everything in this thing. So you sell it and then you all of a sudden see it turn back up, and then you buy it, but then you lose again. And you decide, I'm never going to invest in that stock again because somehow it doesn't like me.
Yeah, somehow it doesn't like you. Which actually brings me to an important part of the book, which is how our own sort of expectations of ourselves that started developing, way back when we were kids, that we project them onto the stocks and onto the market overall. And we don't know that we're doing this. It's another reason to make a serious effort to actually know the emotional context, because obviously there's no stock that doesn't like you.
Right.
But it doesn't mean it doesn't. It truly doesn't. It feels that way.
Tempur-Pedic doesn't like me. I'm just letting you know that right now. I know that. It just doesn't like me.
There's a side tip related to that, though, by the way.
What's that?
That I'm going to say it in scientific terms, and then I'll put it in regular terms.
Mm-hmm.
Complex decisions are best made non-deliberately. So what that means is, like, if you're, you know, all twisted around in the stock, like, look at all your data about it, take in all the facts, and then say, you know what, I'm going to make the decision while I walk the dog, or I'm going to make the decision while I go for a jog. Like, let the back of your mind go to work on it, and then make a decision about it.
So it's kind of the sleep on it factor. I have a question, though, about the idea of, you know, something I've thought about is oftentimes there's a separation of what we call dumb money and smart money. And I'm not separating it in anything else other than dumb money, and this is not an insult, but dumb money being a herd. You know, it's like, oh, it's down so much, I'm going to buy it, which doesn't have any kind of, you know, thesis in anything other than I'm just going to buy it because it's down. And it's kind of maybe lucky money, you want to call it. Or, oh, my gosh, I really like that camera. And, you know, oh, boy, my friends are buying it, so I'm going to buy the stock in it. You know, what is that all about? Is there any kind of that's kind of using your emotions to buy versus any kind of logic at all?
Well, it is. But here's the funny clue. There's research that shows if you actually think of the market as people's perception, and you consciously think, like, why are other people going to buy this? That's a much better way to think about it than the numbers. So, and if you think about it, that's really all the market is, right?
Right.
It's everybody's collective perception of what something's worth on a given day or not.
Right.
So instead of trying to decide purely from the numbers, just let the numbers be, like, one of your clues, but ask yourself, okay, if I buy this today, who's going to want to pay more for it, you know, next week, next year, next month, or whenever, next 10 years when I want to sell it? Or if I'm going to sell it today, who's likely to want to sell it for less? There's research that shows if you think about the markets that way, as a people game, you're going to come up with a more accurate answer.
And this goes into your discussion in the book, in the middle of the book, actually, about the whole discussion of it's kind of a poker game, you know, and you talk about Stevie Cohen, who, a great investor, who was a terrific poker player, and it's kind of like looking around to understand, okay, what's going on. Now, it's a different game, of course, and, you know, you have a limit in poker, a certain amount of cards, and you mentioned that, oh, there's a lot of stocks out there, but poker is kind of where you're playing the game of, I guess, differently than roulette, because you're not really playing against anything else besides the potential probability of it landing somewhere. Versus poker, you're playing against other people bluffing or, you know, moving in if you think that your cards are better.
Right, right. The buying and selling stocks successfully, or bonds, or futures, or whatever, is a whole lot better played like poker than any other game, when you really do understand that the cards are only, like, half of it at best. Those probabilities are only half of it. I mean, like the hedge fund traders in the stories, they play with the cards down. You know?
Right, right.
They're just looking at each other to sort of figure out, you know, reading what's on somebody else's face. And I think I say this in the book. Well, actually, I think this ended up getting taken out, but why do professional poker players always have, like, a hat or sunglasses on? So other people can't read what's going on, because that's really what it's about.
Right.
What's the other guy going to do? That's a great risk management. You know, you may be inclined to buy the stock of that camera company you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You got to ask yourself, you know, where are the 10,000 other people, or, you know, a million other people who are going to pay more for this stock than I'm going to pay for it today?
Right.
That's the answer you want.
Or who in the right mind is paying $4,000 for a mattress at Tempur-Pedic?
Yes, right.
You know?
Right.
But they seem to be doing it somehow, but okay. You know, it's interesting that you talk about the eyeglasses and the shades, if you will. And in Daniel Callahan's book, is that his right name?
Kahneman.
Yeah, Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. He talks about the whole pupil dilation discussion, about when you're thinking too much and you have too much of a kind of an in-depth thought process, that your pupils dilate. And that's the tell that obviously people are looking to get away from in that. And sometimes when you think too deeply, you can make just as many mistakes as if you think too superficially, right?
Yeah. I mean, a human brain is really good at pattern recognition. And we've just been taught to rely on the numbers too much and to think that there is some magical answer there in the numbers. That goes back to kind of the complex decisions non-deliberately thing, where, you know, take the factors in. Yeah, you should probably know what they are, although I'll say having that answer to the people is more important. And then let your unconscious pattern recognition go to work on it and give you an answer as opposed to try to sort of force the data to give you an answer.
Right. You talk about some, you have a lot of acronyms going on here with a lot of little curly Q letters that make it look very official.
Oh, wow, it worked.
Yes, it did. You fooled me. No. One of them you call FOMO, F-O-M-O. We're familiar with POMO, which is Permanent Open Market Operations by the Fed. But FOMO is fear of missing out. And you have a little small F there with a big C. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Okay. So the F with the C stands for feeling context. It basically means you should always know what your feeling context is, what the context of feelings that you're experiencing in any judgment call you're making. So that's all. I use FC, I use that FC, and I use EC, emotional context, feeling context. I sort of use them interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of missing out is a extremely common, if not the most common, feeling context that operates when people are in the markets. So, like, say something's going against you. Oftentimes the reason you don't get out when you get the first signs that you should get out is you're afraid it's going to come back. And that's fear of missing out.
And you're going to be wrong, but being right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you don't get out until the pain's too great, of course, and then you get out. But it works on both sides. It works when the stock's going against you. It works when you buy, you know, some tech stock that's probably, you're going to be close to the last buyer. Because you're afraid, like, you put off, it's too expensive, and then you're so tired of hearing all your friends say they made money on Apple that you finally say, okay, I have to give in.
I'm buying. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, the idea that you are, we've been reprogrammed to work on much more of a analytical basis when it comes to stocks is kind of the baseline of what you say is really a bad thing, right?
I mean, it is a bad thing,
right? So it's a bad thing, but at the same time, how then do you seriously? You're dealing with money, you're dealing with movement, and these days the movement is much faster.
Right.
Talk about the last year where you saw this incredible chop in the markets, where the markets go down for whatever reason, I don't care why, and they go down 10-12%, and then they're kind of plodding along, nothing really changed. Then one day out of nowhere, it's like, wham, it moves higher. Now,
right.
if you were inclined to just, you know, not care about money and whatever, you just throw your money in at that point, or throw it into the bottom, wherever you want to call it, and because it was straight up from there. And, you know, you want to do measurement and you want to do all this Fibonacci retracement. Forget all that. The fact of the matter is that almost in this market condition, euphoria should be sold and panic should be bought.
Well, that's certainly the market condition we're in now. And the market does, like, go through personality changes. So it's in this, you know, range-bound personality now, which makes selling euphoria and buying panic a good idea. But if it's a trend market, like we've certainly seen plenty of, you know, in the past 20 years, let's say, that's not a strategy that works. So you've got to know what, it's a perfect example. Knowing what the overall market personality is more important than knowing what the actual numbers are.
Right, right. I mean, because, you know, a market that is in a chop and is in a consolidating / range bound could turn into a trend at any time. The question is when.
Right. Well, that's one of those things where it does help to have some criteria that you know that it's a true change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it really solidly above, like, the last year's highs,
right,
for example? I mean, it's something that shows that it's moved out of whatever range it's been in.
And you were actually a trader for a while. I know you have some family history of trading, and you got into this, I think, some time ago and good knowledge of the markets. Now, one of the interesting things about what I've been thinking of is if we know, and I say we, the collective we, or at least maybe some of the we, know that there is this psychological bantering going on that, you know, there is this psychology going on, right? So that you can almost, in a way, bluff your way into moving higher or lower, let's say, and then turning the table. Classic poker play, right?
Right.
Because it doesn't matter what your cards are, really. You know, the fact is, if you have the bigger stack or you have the better play, and by the way, just for those listening, I think it's very interesting that the same players get to the final tables all the time.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Their cards are just as random as yours or mine, but they seem to get to the final table all the time. So, so here's the thing. If it was possible, in theory, to know what that kind of feel is, we'll call it, we'll know where the pain is, where people are going to blow out, where people... It would be kind of interesting if you could program that into a computer and then run these algorithms to we'll call it the emotional pain threshold algorithm, okay? That you blow into the futures and you blow out of the futures and you know, you do something disruptive in markets, force people out and then force them back in, and kind of you'd get almost the action that we've seen recently.
Well, there's certainly a lot of people out there trying to program computers to do just exactly that. Now, having spoken at a lot of their conferences, you know, at the end of the day, I got to say, I don't know if their algorithms are as smart as we like to, they like us to think they are, or maybe the news media likes to make it sound. The other thing that's interesting about it is how often they reprogram their algorithms, or some of them
do, at least. Right.
You know, it ends up just being a robotic arm, because
mm-hmm.
They're constantly tweaking them. And it's a very competitive game, algorithm to algorithm.
Right, because now the algorithms could fight each other.
Well, and they do a lot of fighting each other, which is actually, you know, I do think that given the percentage of trading that goes on day-to-day algorithm-wise, the average person has got to just ignore 300-400-point swings, because if something happens, the algorithms are going to battle it out for 300 or 400 points, and that becomes meaningless in a way that it didn't used to. Because trading can happen so fast, I mean, as we've seen, you know, moving 300 or 400 points can happen a lot more quickly than it did 20 years
ago. Listen, I have friends that were market makers, the old time, you know, market real, you know.
Right.
They said they can't do this anymore. They said that it's impossible because they get faked out at every turn.
Yeah. And so many of the algorithms are about faking each other out. But, you know, so one of the things, like if predicting other people is a valuable skill in markets, which it is,
mm-hmm.
a study from Caltech shows that it is, you know, just play in your own sandbox, kind of. So the algorithms can duke it out with each other, but there's also, you know, plenty of other people that aren't using algorithms that are trading or investing on your time frame.
Right.
And think of yourself as playing. You know, so you're playing at the poker table that's your level, basically.
Right.
You can do the same thing in markets. You can play at the market level that's your level.
I hear you. Now you have
your time frame.
Right, exactly, because that could be long or short, depending on what it is.
Right.
Now you have a chapter here, chapter 21, Getting Back in the Game, the Coup d'etat Capital Trader Training Manual, a note on the psychological of dealing with uncertainty. Again, you look at uncertainty as the future and differentiate that with risk. But what is, you know, some people who are like, just, I can't deal with these markets, I don't want to be involved in them. You know, we know historically that equities, generally speaking, have been a really good place to be. You know, not all, but, you know, good quality companies. But yet people are spooked about, you know, some of this volatility and some of the uncertainty. I personally am totally disgusted with the amount of interaction and intervention by governments. I think it's just terribly, terribly destructive to markets. That's my opinion. But, you know, anyway, you know, how do you talk to somebody about and train somebody, aside from reading your book and all that, I mean, to kind of say, you know what, these things will happen. The question is, do you want to be out of it, or do you want to at least have a shot at something? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
I'm not typically a big salesperson for myself, but no. I'm going to say not aside from reading my book. Honestly, I do think it's the first book out there to be realistic about the role of emotions in decision-making and how you can feel what you feel and then choose to analyze that
mm-hmm.
and decide which feelings are relevant to the decision you're going to make.
Right.
So you might have a really good reason for, you know, feeling scared of the markets, being burned by the markets.
Right.
But maybe if you analyze that, you'll let yourself feel it, put it into words, describe it. It's sort of almost like a mourning or, you know, a getting over anything kind of process.
Right.
You come, psychologically, you know, then you come to a place like, okay, wait a minute, you know, that is how I feel about it, but I also do need to take some risk with my money, and you know, I don't need the money for 10 or 20 years or 5 years or whatever it is, and so I'll be able to stick my toe in the water.
Right.
The trick is, You can do that if you let yourself feel the emotion and put it into words and value it as data, because that's what your brain's doing. If you don't do it, you try to use your intellect, it's never going to work.
Yeah.
Emotions are more powerful than the intellect, hands down. But we haven't been taught to use them, so we're really fighting ourselves.
And you know what? At the same time, in the modern day of utilizing, this is kind of offbeat here, but the modern day of utilizing communications via texting and Facebook and all that, the emotional, I always say, when you send an email, you got to be careful, because the emotional context of what you're saying sometimes is absolutely lost.
Totally. But see what you're actually saying? The person on the other end can't really understand it necessarily the way that you meant it.
Right.
Because they don't have that other data that if you were standing there, or even if you were talking on the phone, they are taking in and they are processing. They're just not conscious of it, and they weren't taught in school to do it. They were taught, just not explicitly.
Right. I could say the same thing to you 10 feet away as I could say nose to nose with you. That nose to nose is going to have a different context.
Totally.
Context
is everything, whether it's Dow 12,000, in which direction you're to come from, or the internal context you bring to how you're perceiving what the markets are doing, and then whatever judgment call you make. Context is everything.
Now, one more thing, and I think I want to ask you this, and we can close this, but when you look at a situation where somebody is emotional because they think they're right, or they think they're wrong, either way you want to look at it, with the market, you know, and investment, and you know, do you think that the emotional side of things, you say, okay, wait a minute, you know, you want it to be in this stock, and the stock is moving against you, and you're emotionally scared about it. I mean, when is it okay to act on that, and when is it not okay to act on that?
Well, I'm gonna pick the time when they think that they're right,
mm-hmm.
and say, go into the issue of what's so important about being right. And I'm going to guarantee you that what's so important about being right has nothing to do with the market and everything to do with how they needed to be right growing up and proving they were smart.
And this is the same people that had a problem going to the bathroom, obviously.
Yeah, probably. believe me, when I talk to... If you really attach to being right, it doesn't have to do with the here and now. It has to do with proving to somebody that you were smart. And
yeah.
when people start to figure out that, hey, wait a minute, do I want to be smart or do I want to have more money? And
yeah.
they start to realize that emotion from the past is operating, which is actually really the most important part in the book. It's the part about the fractal psyche.
Where I am right now. That's where I actually have that dog yeah. right now. Look at that. That's chapter, what is that, chapter 14.
Yeah. That's really the most important part, because people get all caught up in reenacting these things from, you know, way back when in the market. Because the market's like this perfect, you know, foil or fodder that you can do whatever you want. Like, another thing is, if you've had an argument with anybody, spouse, teenager, mother, father, dog, guy on the highway, whatever, don't make a trading or investment decision. Because you have an argument with somebody, it makes you feel out of control, right? Because they won't
yep.
listen to you.
Yep.
But you can turn to your account, and that market will listen. It'll buy that stock.
Oh, yeah. Whether you're right.
It'll
yeah.
let you buy, right.
All the way down.
It'll give you
all the way down.
This false feeling that you're in control.
Right.
It has nothing to do with it. You really just want your wife to listen to what you said.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I'll tell you something. I talked to my wife about this all the time. I said, you know what, honey, do me a favor. I just need a little bit of space when we're, you know, about this situation here, because I'm really trying to kind of look at a few things and all that, and I don't think... My head just doesn't feel right, and I can't get around what I'm doing. So I have two choices. Either I don't do what I have to do in this circumstance, right? Whatever it is, right? Or I continue fighting, which can be fun, I suppose. And, or, you know, I just, you know, try to figure something out. But, you know, you're right. When you're maybe not enough sleep, hungover, fighting, you know, or you have a situation where you're absolutely wrong, you don't want to rebound and get hooked into, you know, that where you're making bad decisions on top of bad decisions.
I cannot tell you how many traders and investors of all stripes, and I mean from the average retail guy to a hedge fund with multi-billion dollars under their management, have told me, you know, they had a fight with their teenager, and lo and behold, they looked at their account, and why did I do that?
Right.
And then they realized that, you know, they were acting out their frustration from the other situation with the, in a different situation that they could at least give them the illusion of feeling under control
right.
for the moment.
Well, in terms of psychology, all my listeners know that, you know, this is kind of something I always talk about, the redhead syndrome, where I'm banging my head against the desk sometimes. Because, you know, when you get totally involved, you have six screens around you, you got things happening in news. It's like, what's going on with that? But anyway, you know what you should do? Check out this book, Market Mind Games. Hey, by the way, is this in Kindle version and all that too?
It is in Kindle.
Oh, okay.
And Nook.
I have the hardbound. Nice copy here. I like the cover and the pages. But check it out. It is Market Mind Games, Denise Schull. She's founder of the Rethink Group. She's up in New York, and I know that she's going to eventually be down in Florida, right? So you're going to come visit me?
Yes.
Good. Excellent. I'd like to spend a little time and screw my head back on straight one of these days. How's that?
We'll try.
All right. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we're going to switch over now from the whole idea of the psychology of the markets and the more ethereal and complex emotional side of things to some more of a reality check here. And with us today, we have, as I mentioned earlier, we have Katie North, who is the Senior Finance Policy Analyst with Bloomberg Government. And we're very happy to have her. Hey, Katie, how are you?
Hi.
So listen, we got lots to kind of dig into. You wrote some great reports on this whole issue of evaluating systematically important non-banks. And I think for our listeners, it would be great for you to tell us what's going on. I mean, what is this all about?
Well, the issue that Dodd-Frank was trying to address with figuring out who these potential non-banks that could be systemically important to the economy are is the whole concept of Lehman Brothers, which is what first started this out, is that you could have a very large non-banking entity that could potentially cause a lot of problems in the marketplace overall. Another example of that was American International Group and the all of the information and that went along with that, and the tremendous government support that ensued after, you know, AIG ran into so many problems. And so what the authors of Dodd-Frank tried to do is create a framework for figuring out not only who these hedge funds, insurance firms, broker-dealers potentially could be that might, you know, play a role in the economy going forward if there should be another financial crisis, but look at ways to rein them in and rein in their risk so that they wouldn't cause a need for a bailout in the future.
Right. So, and they call this SIFI, Systematically Important Financial Institutions, or SIFI, or as I call it, SIFI. But nonetheless, let me ask you a few questions on this, because I read all your reports. You put out one last Wednesday, I believe, then on Friday and Thursday and Friday. Here's the questions. Number one, from what I can see, there is still a lot of open-endedness to this. So we don't really exactly know who's going to be or not, because Treasury Secretary Geithner gets an absolute vote on yay or naying any particular facility, institution. And there's some voting that goes on. And of course, as we've seen with government of late, there's no end to the potential changes that they can make in any law. So far,
that's correct.
Okay. So far, so good, right?
Right.
So now we're in a big guessing game here, which again is kind of the challenge of these markets. There's some cost sharing that goes on. From your notes and from your discussion, there's about, I think it's $7 billion over a period of, a number of years that has to be paid, right?
Right. So some early estimates from the federal government and the Congressional Budget Office show that there are three different funds that will be created as a part of Dodd-Frank and as a part of repaying some costs of regulating these SIFIs, these systemically important institutions. And of those three different funds, including this very large orderly liquidation fund, which is meant to repay the government after some extra support might need to come into play to help bail out some of these firms in the future, they expect that all of those funds to total about $7 billion or so over 10 years. Now, this would bank systemically important financial institutions, which are the top 34 bank holding companies based in the U.S., and also these non-bank companies that we're talking about today will have to pay into that fund. And the amount will fluctuate from year to year, just depending on what those costs are.
Yeah, but $7 billion, who cares? I mean,
well, $7 billion over 10 years, sure. It's not a whole lot, but it is, you know, it's something to think about. It's, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the Financial Stability Oversight Council released kind of their analysis on some of the assessments that they're going to use to repay the financial research fund, for instance. And it's about 0.0005% of a fee, which is not all that much. But you start to look at having a lot of these things add up, and there are some potential tangible costs there.
Well, but I meant more so, not only is it not a lot of money, but it's a lot of money, but not a lot of money in terms of what they had to pay. But but it could add up. But I'm more concerned about what the usage is. Now, you listed a variety of usages, and of course, there's regulatory fees and just running the operation. But does this have anything to do with more of paying back the regulation and the process of doing this, or is this also setting up a fund in case somebody fails?
Well, it's a little bit of both. Some of them are repaying the costs of the increased regulation and oversight and staffing and time that the regulators will be spending. But in particular, where most of this is coming from is the Orderly Liquidation Fund. And this is almost like a shot in the dark in terms of estimating potential costs there, because this fund is not like the FDIC Insurance Fund, which is funded ahead of time, ahead of any potential need to pay back depositors. It's actually funded after there's any failure. Mm-hmm. So what would happen in the future is a very large financial firm failed. The government would have to come and make some guarantees, help write off some of the debt so that someone else could buy the firm or maybe multiple pieces of the firm. And all of the costs would be added up, and then the entire conglomeration of systemically important financial institutions, both banks and non-banks, would then have to pay back those costs.
So is the failure of a non-systematically important bank covered by this money?
Yes, it would be.
So now we have too big to fail and too small to fail.
You do. So but the idea is that hopefully with the regulations, or the intention of the regulation, is to find those firms that would potentially cause problems with the economy and get them on this list of systemically important institutions so that they would be eligible to pay back these costs if they were imposed on the federal government.
The problem is that we have gone, in a matter of a decade, I've talked about this before, and it's still mind-blowing every time I think about it. We've gone from a matter in a decade of having $100 million being like, oh my, to, all right, so what? I mean, seriously. I mean, the amount of billions of dollars is just mind-blowing. I don't know how it got here so fast, and we can't say inflation, all that. It's just like it just boop, appeared, billion.
Right.
I mean, it's just crazy.
The order of magnitude has definitely changed quite a lot when it comes to government support and talking about this in the financial crisis.
Hmm. So here's a question. One of the people you have on, or not you, but one of the people they have on this panel is, you know, it's all the big mucky mucks. They have, of course, they have Sheila Bair and all the big, you know, number one positions from all the various financial organizations. One of them they have is Gary Gensler. He's with the CFTC. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, you have a gent who in there is involved with trying to set up rules in the last year and a half. He's late, admittedly, himself admittedly, late on finishing any kind of derivative legislation and the whole, you know, transparency issue with the CFTC. Any comments on his overall placement in the future, his inability to get anything done, and this is my opinion, his apparent lack of any kind of ability to regulate?
Well, one of the challenges that a couple of the regulators are facing, because they do rely on appropriations from Congress, is staffing and having the available technology and funding to do their jobs. And one of the challenges in particular with the derivatives markets is that they're having to write a lot of this from scratch. They're bringing over-the-counter derivatives, which were virtually unregulated products, and trying to figure out how to carefully craft these regulations so that they don't cause unintended consequences in the marketplace. And through that, you know, they're obviously having a lot of meetings with outside stakeholders. All the regulators are. And one of the things that that you can do, anyone can do, is go in and take a look at the list of who Gary Gensler and his staff are meeting with to find out, you know, who he's talking to and what the context of the conversation was. So they're having to do this very carefully. And I think, you know, the goal is to try and get it done on time, but it's a little bit more difficult to deliver just by the sheer largeness and the nature of what it is they're trying to do. And, mm-hmm. you know, the same thing is happening at the Securities and Exchange Commission. They were charged with creating a lot of new regulations and creating actual new offices within the SEC to handle rating agencies and hedge funds. And a lot of that has had to be put on hold just because of the fact that they don't have the staffing or the funding levels necessary to do that.
Well, it's scary. I'm sorry, but it's amazing that we don't have this to begin with, and it's scary that we don't have the people to then come in after the fact, after the mess is made, to clean up. And scary in the fact that we were so ill-prepared to begin with, don't you think?
It is, and it's an interesting conundrum that, you know, Congress has authorized, you know, to do all these various things and to have this very large piece of legislation go forward and be implemented, but not provide the backing necessary to get it done. And that's sort of one of the things that's happening politically. And,
right.
You know, as you go through this. And the other interesting thing about implementing some of this is that there's going to be a lot of legal challenges, too. Even if they can get some of the stuff done on time or later than expected, it's going to be many, many years before a lot of this stuff is played out legally as well. There's already been a number of challenges, some of which have succeeded.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you ever see that game show where it's, you know, the people are charged with two different teams of making a dinner for under $10, you know, that kind of game show? And
right.
This is kind of like legislation on a budget, you know, under a, not only on a budget, but on a budget that's underneath the level that needs to be, you know, and the consequences are devastating if they get it wrong. Pretty funny. Anyway, what is the cost now? Two things. I guess there's two components here, and it's the same issue. We talked about the $7 billion. We talked about this whole idea that, you know, it's going to be costing for various large organizations, et cetera. What's the effect on the consumer, do you think?
Well, that's something that's a little bit harder to take a look at and to predict because, obviously, if you're an insurance firm and you're going to be hit with new fees and new regulations, it's going to cause, you know, problems with your bottom line. And so the tendency would be to pass those costs along to the consumer. But as far as, you know, taking a look at that and trying to estimate potential costs on the consumer at this point, because there are so many unknowns, it's a little bit more difficult to do.
Right.
But certainly it's not outside the realm of possibility that a lot of these fees and things like that will definitely be passed on to the consumer, or in the case of banks, you know, to commercial clients and other companies as well.
Yeah, I know there's an article also written on Friday that discussed the chart of the day for Bloomberg. I'm going to pull that up and put that on the podcast notes for this episode. But I have a couple of just other quickies. First of all, I know in the original list that you had put out, there was, you know, again, these are just speculation of who could be SIFIs. But you had Standard & Poor's and Moody's, I believe, on there, or maybe it was Fitch. They were not maybe included on your second listing. What was that about?
Well, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and none of the rating agencies were actually included on the ultimate list. They were included as potential non-bank firms that might be eligible, but the fact that they don't have the number of assets or the types of, you know, CDS written against them, or outstanding derivatives, which are some of these quantitative metrics that the FSOC is looking at, means that they wouldn't ultimately be considered, at least through this first round, mm-hmm. and under the proposal.
Right. And then finally, I guess, you know, it was great that you had company responses in here in your second report. And I thought it was interesting that if I could sum this up with a few, exemptions here, basically, none of the companies that responded felt that really this had to do with them.
Right.
That's
a pretty good way to sum it up. you know, the insurance, for instance, the insurance companies are saying, you know, by nature of insurance, they're not systemically risky to the economy. Interestingly, a lot of the government-sponsored entities and federal home loan banks, Fannie and Freddie, they because they have a lot of outstanding loans and bonds on their balance sheets, you know, technically qualify for this, but the interesting thing is that some of them, like Fannie and Freddie, are already under government support.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting conundrum there. But again, they're saying, well, we've been exempted from other regulations, so we should be exempted from this too. You know, many of the broker-dealers are questioning whether or not they will use assets under management, which can oftentimes be significantly
much larger than
the assets they actually have, mm-hmm. You know, on their actual balance sheet. So they suggest that, you know, they're not systemically significant because the actual, you know, assets on their balance sheet don't rise to that level of the $50 billion threshold.
Right.
So there's lots of reasons why many of these entities are considering why they wouldn't be considered. Some of the entities agree that they might be considered, GE Capital for one. They said, you know, we understand we may be considered as a systemically important institution, but it's very important to recognize that GE Capital is a subsidiary of the broader General Electric corporation, and it should really, these regulations should focus mostly on the subsidiary versus the company
right.
as a whole.
Right.
I think Berkshire Hathaway would run into that as well as a potential issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are many financial subs, but the company as a whole, you know, shouldn't be regulated, and that's what the companies seem to be suggesting.
But it's funny, because you look at some of the insurance companies, they took plenty of money when things were not going well for them. And
yes.
at this time they're saying, but we're not really that important. Well, if you're not that important, you should have not taken the money and gone out of business. You know?
Right.
It's kind of, you know, everybody wants it both ways. I guess finally, one, I thought it was glaringly missing, and maybe I'm wrong about this entirely, but, you know, GM split off their banking in, subsidiary, you know, this Ford Motor Credit and et cetera. Isn't Ally Capital part of GM? Or
yes, but they are actually organized as a bank holding company with the Federal Reserve, which means they are already subject to federal regulation.
Mm, I see.
And they're already, because they have that, I forget what their total assets are at this point, but they already could be systemically important as a bank, not as a non-bank.
No, they're important only because they have great commercials. They have
right.
the best commercials, right? Anything else that you want to add to this whole thing? When is it going to come to a little bit more of a head here? When are we going to know some more information and you know, whatever else may be important here for us?
Yeah, so the next steps is really for the Financial Stability Oversight Council, this group of regulators, to finalize these rules. Right now, it's just in proposal. It's in draft form. So they're going to be working on that this year after receiving a lot of comments from the industry. And they could make changes to this three-stage process that they've laid out. And what they're going to do as well is wait and try to receive a lot of information from this new Office of Financial Research, which has become known by some as the CIA of the financial industry, where they have the authority to go in and request a lot of data on financial products, on all the different entities within financial companies, and try and get a better handle on how potentially a broker-dealer or a payment servicer provider might become systemically important in the future. And with a lot of that data, the FSOC plans or has a goal to maybe come in and make changes to this rule after the fact and maybe create different buckets of this regulation that would apply to different types of companies.
Yeah.
And, you know, overall, we estimate it could be 2014, 2015, even before many of these companies, once designated, have to actually come into compliance with a lot of the Federal Reserve's rules on capital, on liquidity, on even looking at potential mergers and acquisitions. You know, and that's 5-6 years after the financial crisis. So if one thing is for sure, you know, this is a long iterative process.
Oh, yeah.
And it will evolve over time.
Right.
The FSOC, this panel, is going to be looking at companies year after year and to reconsider whether or not they still are systemically important. So so there will be a lot of changes, I think. It just will take time.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then we didn't even talk about Basel rules. I mean, that's whole, you know, you throw that into the whole situation. I was down at Curacao recently, and I was doing some diving. Went on a night dive, and there was a nice fellow in there. I started talking. Turns out, for a very large bank, he is one of the fellas that does some of the work getting them in line with the Basel regulations. Now, they're still on Basel 2, and
right.
there's Basel 3 going on, right? And, you know, it seems that they're having, this has taken 3 years already just to get up to this level, and they're still not there. So, you know, and it's just regulatory issues and all, you know, putting things in place. But you know what? I got to tell you something. In the end, the financial industry did it themselves. You know, they could have self-regulated better, in my opinion. They could have done a better job at trying better to, you know, hold back their greed mongering and everything that went on during the whole financial crisis. And this isn't the first time either. They got a couple of times in the past that they got kind of waivers and got to continue on doing what they do. This is kind of like a third strike here, you know, where they almost took things down, right? So I think that in a way, they're deserving a little bit of this oversight from mama and papa, unfortunately. You know, I'm not thrilled about it, though.
Yeah, there certainly is. There's a lot of moving parts to this, and there's not a lot of coordination going on amongst different types of regulations, how they might intertwine or affect one another. You know, another aspect of this is the Volcker Rule, which hasn't been finalized, but non-bank SIFIs will have to comply with the Volcker Rule, as well as banks, and there's a lot of unknowns as to how some of those regulations might be in direct conflict with maybe the derivatives regulations or the systemically important regulations. So there's really a lot of questions, I think, coming in from the industry too.
Yeah, I think we both agree that the lawyers are very happy.
There is a lot of activity going on amongst the lawyers in Washington, D.C.
I'm sure. Hey, listen, thank you so much, Kathy North, from Bloomberg over in the Senior Financial Policy Analyst area, writing some great things on Bloomberg government and on the Bloomberg site, and obviously you can find it on Bloomberg.com. This is a couple of reports that are entitled Evaluating Systematically Important Non-Banks and 25 U.S. non-banks as considered systematically important that you could check out. And we'll put the chart of the day that's up there and all that's there. And forgive me about the name. It's Katie, but you have an interesting spelling with C-A-D-Y. So it's staring me in the face and it doesn't come to my mind. I'm sorry. I apologize. But I like you and you're very full of knowledge.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, have a good day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I just couldn't for the life of me get her name right. It's Katie. I don't know why I wasn't talking to her. I was tongue-tied, and she spelled it C-A-T-Y. I don't know. Maybe that's why I thought it was Catty. But it's Katie North. Nice, nice discussion and some great insight in terms of what's going on with the whole systematically important banks and all. Anyway, we have that, and of course, you really need to at least take a look at some of the, go to Amazon and check out a few of the pages over on the book we talked about, which was Market Mind Games. I thought it's fascinating. I mean, I'm almost done with it. And, I usually skim a book first and come back, and I couldn't stop. It was just fantastic. I thought it was, at least. There was some great revelations in there from what I saw. Anyway, so we'll be back next week. Sorry we're one day late for the holiday this week. And I thought what we'd do is I'd give you the end. We'll do a little ditty of the compliance and disclosures, and I'll play the rest of that. If you're interested, I don't know, maybe you're not interested, but the Kirby Stone 4 song from 1958, it's a really big show because probably a lot of times when I do put some of that on, people say, where's the rest of that? So I'll put it on the end of this. So you don't want it, turn it off. And if you want to listen to it, there it is. So, well, I thank you very much. I'll see you real soon. And that's all I can say for a happy, profitable, prosperous week. And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.
Everybody's feeling gay when they hear this fella say,
there's a really big shoe tonight. A really big shoe tonight.
We got 16 tons of atomic ore. We got next year's Army Navy score and the first four battles of the Civil War.
It's a really big show tonight.
It's a really big show tonight.
Shoe, not show.
It's a really big shoe tonight.
Now you've got it. We've got a spaceship blasting off for you and an in-person visit from the entire Bronx Zoo.
And the guy who invented Asiatic food.
That's a really, really big one tonight.
Don't you love to hear and say,
here's Ben Hogan. Ben, hit one into the audience.
He can take your blues away. That familiar phrase has become a craze.
A really big show tonight. Yes, sirree, we've got a beauty for you tonight.
We got Noah's Ark from the far-off past. We're gonna reproduce an atomic blast. We got World War II with the original cast.
We've got a really, really, really big one tonight.
Don't you love to hear him say,
there's some Mama warriors out there. Hello, fellas.
He can take your blues away. That familiar phrase has become a craze.
A really big show tonight. Yes, sir, we've really got a spectacle for you this time.
We'll take a TV trip to the moon and stars. First a hop to Venus, then a jump to Mars.
And next week, Jupiter will be ours. On this shoe, we really get around, don't we?
It's a really big show.
Shoe, not show.
And we're all gonna go.
Goose.